Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail. Here are your hosts, Trent Kling and Leighton Kling.
Welcome to another Retail Focus Podcast. Lots of earnings to discuss. So many things to discuss, in fact, that we won't even get to Home Depot's recent earnings on this particular show. And before we get to department stores like Kohl's, Nordstrom, and JCPenney, Leighton, the latest retail numbers came out from the U.S. government for October, and a lot of positive signals for the retail industry overall, especially when you look at those core retail numbers.
Yeah, the U.S. Department of Commerce said on Thursday that retail sales, now this is going to include automobile sales, gasoline, and building materials, but including these categories, retail sales increased 0.8% for the month of October, and they also ended up revising the numbers for September. They increased that comp to 1% from 0.6 as previously posted. So these are really good numbers indicating that the retail sector is strong overall. And you and I are both excited to see these numbers. On a year-over-year basis, retail sales, including both September and October, through these revised numbers, rose 4.3%. So that is an amazing figure here. Excluding these categories of automobiles, gasoline, and building materials, and food services, retail sales jumped 0.8% in the month of October and 0.3% in September. Previously posted numbers for the month of September shows consumer sales rose 0.1%. So 0.3% is a better figure there as well. So those are the numbers we really wanted to focus on. The numbers that are excluding those automobile sales and gasoline and things of that nature. We're trying to focus on the consumer spending for home goods and things of that nature. Overall, you see these increases coming from a bump in receipts from online retailers. There was a 1.5% increase in October through these online retailers. We always talk about Amazon and how they've increased their market share overall and have taken sales from a lot of brick and mortar retailers here domestically. Sales in building material stores increased 1.1% also. So not as big of a jump as you see within the online retail segment, but this is a significant increase, and a lot of this is due in part to the hurricanes on the East Coast. But Home Depot, as you mentioned, did report earnings this week and had a robust statement coming in with positive earnings and reiterating their fiscal year sales numbers. So a lot of good material here. And as a result, you see a lot of retailers getting a little bit of a bump on the news, at least those that are publicly traded.
Pretty much the only publicly traded retailer that didn't get a significant bump was Home Depot, who released earnings yesterday. And as you mentioned, pretty solid earnings overall, but a lot of shareholders and investors didn't necessarily like that they didn't raise guidance for the upcoming quarters and for the year overall. We'll use these solid retail numbers as a framework for the rest of the Retail Focus show, as we've got five news stories for you, and we begin in department stores with JCPenney. Now, JCPenney reported their third quarter earnings last Friday before trading. They did struggle to bring in quality sales in terms of top line revenue for the quarter, but did improve their earnings per share. Same store sales down 0.8% overall for the quarter, but they did issue guidance on full year same store sales. They expect it to increase between 1% and 2%. Something we've talked about on the show in the past is JCPenney rolling out appliance sales in many of their stores, and that's something that they attempted to execute a lot in the third quarter. However, one of the aspects that they mentioned in this earnings release was they felt like the execution as far as adding the appliances into the stores wasn't as smooth. They mentioned that this caused a perceived disruption for customers, and that's one of the reasons why their same store sales and their comp sales were down a little bit in the first 2 months of the quarter. But they did note that in the final month of the third quarter, they saw an increase in appliance sales and an increase overall in top line revenue because of the appliance sales. And they feel like that portends very good growth for the fourth quarter now that we're into the holiday season. And as we've mentioned before, they're one of the few remaining mall anchors, them and Sears, left with a robust appliance section, especially after JCPenney has added the appliances. So really, when they say that appliances played a negative factor on overall sales, they really don't mean the actual appliance sales, but rather the execution of getting the appliances into stores and making some of their stores a little bit messy for customers. They saw the same thing a year ago when they started to expand Sephora concepts into a number of their stores throughout the country. Now they've got 578 Sephora locations, and that's one of the main drivers of JCPenney's overall growth. Can we expect the same thing with appliances going forward?
Yeah, I think they definitely can. That was one of the things that they had talked about on this third quarter earnings call, was trying to have an extended rollout with their stores in regards to these appliances. I think over 500 appliance rollouts have happened so far. And you talk about Sephora locations with 578 in total there inside JCPenney's stores. So overall, there's a lot of different things happening here in this earnings call. If you look at JCPenney's, they are one of the last anchors here in the United States in the mall space. And I think this is very important for them going forward to prove out that they can be sustainable. You see Macy's and Sears both having a number of store closings over the past 2 years. And I think JCPenney really has to take advantage of this. And one of the ways they can take advantage of the Sears closings is by focusing on extending those appliance rollouts. Also, the Sephora partnership is very strong. I think if you look at Sephora and a company like Ulta Beauty, that is definitely a growth space in the retail industry. I think they can keep drawing customers to their stores. And then also you see the partnership with Ashley Furniture in over 80 stores. For a little while there, as some of our listeners may remember, about 2 years ago, they tried to have a furniture extension, more of an exclusive brand extension, and the price points were a little bit higher. But here with Ashley Furniture, which is a very popular company here in the United States now, coming in with a lower price point, I think that is very important for their core customer base. They're going back to some value pricing, and I think if you're going to have furniture, I think something like this that carries brand recognition along with that lower price point is the thing to do. They also cited strengths in store pickup and online shopping. Obviously, being a mall anchor, you're going to want to focus more on the shopping experience for those customers in store. But to have this omni-channel infrastructure built out and to improve the capital expenditures related to this, I think is very important. We talk about customer experience and how they're trying to bring in more traffic into these once-fledgling JCPenney stores. I think this is definitely going to help them in the long term. They also tried to have more of an online selection. They cited more items online than ever before. And I think that's something that we talk about with Walmart, and that they're really up against a lot of big powerhouse online retailers such as Amazon that have 10, 20, 30 times the amount of products online that they do. But for JCPenney's, this is very important because we're going to be talking about some of the competitors later on in this podcast, but they're really up against other retailers such as Kohl's that have already been spending millions of dollars in building out their e-commerce realm. So I think for the company, this is very good in that you don't see sales dropping too much, but you also see, as you had mentioned earlier, an increase in profit relative to expectations. Just to touch on that a little bit, gross margins did decrease from 37.3% in the same quarter last year to 37.2%. Selling, general, and administration expenses did actually come down as a percentage of sales, also from 32.7% to 31.1%. So they have a little bit better of a share float, which is why they came in with a little bit better earnings per share number, but they are going to be having to focus on those expenses going forward. Not necessarily all of them. They're going to be having to promote their sales a little bit more, especially in these seasonal months when you see a lot of promotions through Black Friday and the New Year's timeframe. But overall, like we keep saying, a lot of dynamic features with JCPenney, and it's interesting to see how they're still alive after, for years now, some analysts have been speculating that JCPenney will be no more.
JCPenney certainly has put together a few strong quarters, and they've put together growth in part because they haven't shied away from business-to-business partnerships. We mentioned Sephora, we mentioned their build-out of their appliance sector, but I think the Ashley Furniture partnership has the most upside. Currently, they have Ashley Furniture in over 80 stores, but this is something that Ashley Furniture wants as well. They want to continue operating, of course, their own retail stores, and on that end, Ashley Furniture Home Store has a about 400 brick and mortar stores in the United States, but Ashley only established their e-commerce platform in 2015. So we're looking at a short amount of time where they've been online. And this is something perhaps that JCPenney can capitalize on because customers still aren't used to using the Ashley Furniture e-commerce platform. They can come to JCPenney and see some of those Ashley Furniture selections. Both JCPenney and Ashley Furniture have said they want to extend this partnership program. It's only a matter of executing it on a store level and completing the rollout on a store level as they've already done with appliances this summer and Sephora locations last year. Some of the infrastructure investment JCPenney has to make regards buy online and pickup in store platforms. JCPenney has always offered the buy online pickup in store for most items, and part of this is because they had existing infrastructure from their catalog program, which had taken place for years even before e-commerce was a thing, where you could order out of the JCPenney catalog and get it delivered to the store for store pickup. So a lot of the store-based infrastructure was there. It was just a matter of trying to expedite shipping from JCPenney warehouses to the stores. And that's what they've said they want to work on going forward. They've seen an increased interest in their e-commerce sales. And part of this is driven by a better website and, more importantly, a better search engine. I mentioned a few months ago on the podcast that when you go to jcp.com and you search Pabst, like the beer company, you got rerouted to basically what amounted to a search for women's underwear, which made no sense. Now, if you type in the search term Pabst, they reroute you to something entirely different, which is a search for best, so that at least they try to match up word for word. They don't sell Pabst t-shirts on their website, but some of their connections on their search engine with their graphic tees are a lot better. For example, you mentioned the merchandise that's being sold in stores being available online is something that JCPenney needs to do a better job at. Let's take a t-shirt for the video game character Kirby, for example. This same Kirby t-shirt has been in stores for now a couple of years. Only over the last month or two has it been available on their e-commerce platform. So they are doing a better job trying to get more merchandise onto their e-commerce platform, do a better job delivering the merchandise quickly to stores, and trying to figure out how the omnichannel approach is going to work within their current infrastructure system. And you can certainly see positives on this front. They seem to be executing where they want to execute a little bit better than other stores who have tried the omnichannel approach and have ended up either failing at it or haven't seen quite the reduction in buy online, pickup in store wait times that JCPenney has seen. When you look at headwinds coming up for JCPenney, they mention increased medical costs as far as insurance for their employees. They also cite minimum wage hikes in some states. We mentioned in last week's show that a handful of states did pass minimum wage hikes to be implemented by the year 2020. And they also mentioned that they are competing for web traffic against not only other traditional brick and mortar retailers, but online-only retailers and clothing delivery services, one of which we'll talk about when we discuss Nordstrom. But one of the interesting things to me in this earnings call was they mentioned major appliances as an area where they might see some headwinds, despite the fact that they're investing vigorously in the appliance category. So that's interesting there. And overall, I know, Leighton, you'll talk about their stock price, but their stock price wasn't really moved one way or the other strongly after this earnings call.
No, it wasn't. It was up a little bit, and it's still up a little bit. But as we talk about their strategy and their growth prospects going forward, I did want to mention that they talked about their 2019 outlook. While this is a little bit out as far as the time frame is concerned, this is very important to look at if you're an investor. They predict that 2019 same-store sales will be increasing by around 3%. They want to see gross margins increasing, as does every other company in this retail segment. They see net income coming in between $450 to $500 million. So again, they see that they will be profitable again. This is maybe seen as some grand optimism for the company, but they do have this strategy lined out, and there is some method to their madness. They want earnings per share to come in between $1.40 per share and $1.55 per share, and they want to see reduced debt levels to less than $3 billion. Currently, they have around $3.5 billion, if not a little bit more, on their balance sheet of debt. They also want to achieve this through all of these other closings, through their other competitors. They see a lot of opportunities here overall to take back some market share. But as it relates to their stock price, as you mentioned, they were relatively unfazed. They were trading around $8.50 a share Friday, and now they're trading around $9.20 per share. The stock traded up over 8% at times on Monday, trading around $9.80 per share, so almost hitting that $10 mark. The company currently carries a $3 billion market cap, which is pretty significant, but if you look at their price-to-earnings ratio, it is negative because they have not been carrying a profit for quite some time. So again, you could take a lot of different views for JCPenney overall, but again, if you look at 5 years ago and where people were saying this company was going, they are still around and they are still a player in this space. We will move on to a JCPenney's competitor in Nordstrom. They released their third quarter earnings last Thursday. Results were surprisingly positive for the high-end retailer, despite some incurred costs through the Trunk Club acquisition. The company saw revenues of $3.5 billion, topping analyst expectations of $3.489 billion. So a modest beat on revenue overall. However, this represents a 7.2% increase year over year. The company achieved $3.2 billion in revenue during the same period last year, and the company reported adjusted earnings this quarter of 84 cents per share, beating expectations of 52 cents per share. So quite a beat there. They also increased gross margins to 34.8%. So this is really good, saying that they're operating well, they're executing well, and they're keeping those margins up despite the fact that they've been focusing very much so on the Nordstrom Rack concept.
They certainly have been focusing on the Rack concept, with 15 new Rack stores slated to open up this last fall. Here's what we took away from the Nordstrom earnings release. Well, one of the things that we learned, and we were somewhat skeptical of during their last earnings release, was how significant the shift of their anniversary sale was, because what happened at the end of the second quarter, usually there are 2 weeks where they have their anniversary sale, which is usually their largest event of the year. Well, this year, half of the anniversary sale got shifted to the third quarter. This was a reason the company gave for same-store sales being a little bit down. And in fact, they adjusted their earnings so that it took into account numbers from the anniversary shift. We, at least at the Retail Focus, rolled our eyes a little bit because sometimes we are skeptical of whether or not these things actually matter for a company's bottom line. But we were wrong in being skeptics about this. The anniversary sale for Nordstrom was indeed a significant boost to their third quarter, and that's one of the reasons you saw comps go through the roof in brick and mortar. When you combine the second and third quarter comparative store sales, you get a positive gain of 0.4%. So when you combine, it looks a lot better than in isolation, same store sales being down in the second quarter, and it's all because of movement in that anniversary sale. Now, with those comps being up by 0.4%, even though that lags behind kind of that 2-3% mark that oftentimes we're looking at, that's still pacing or outpacing a lot of industry leaders in the premium department store category. They are excelling where Neiman Marcus isn't, both in brick and mortar and in off-price with their Nordstrom Rack stores. Where Nordstrom is struggling is in the e-commerce realm. Their loyalty program has done great for increasing traffic in their brick and mortar stores. They've seen great feedback on their loyalty program, but it hasn't translated to their e-commerce site. And what's more is, and this is something that I want to look at during this Nordstrom segment, is how Trunk Club and the acquisition of Trunk Club has impacted the Nordstrom bottom line. Let's kind of rewind back to 2014. This is when Nordstrom purchased Trunk Club, which was at the time an online website. Basically, the idea behind Trunk Club is that shopping in stores, and I quote from their own website, is overwhelming and inconvenient. Well, I don't know about that, especially since Nordstrom owns Trunk Club and is trying to drive traffic to their brick and mortar stores. But basically what Trunk Club does is they give you a personal shopping assistant. often called a personal stylist, and this person will gather up clothing styles for you, and you get shipped these trunks or boxes to your door however regularly you so choose. So basically, it's a curated clothing collection. There are a lot of websites out there that do the exact same thing. So that was one of the points skeptics made on this deal, is that Trunk Club was not unique to the overall industry, that there were a lot of people that put together boxes of clothing and shipped that out to consumers. Looking at what analysts said in 2014, there was an analyst for Pando.com, Michael Carney, who said that the deal was a good one for Nordstrom, despite the fact that it was a very high premium over the margin, or the reported margin, of Trunk Club at the time. It was a fairly large multiple on sales for Trunk Club. The idea that this analyst gave, Mr. Carney, said that basically it would be difficult for Nordstrom to bring something like that in-house without bringing in an external company, and it would develop synergies between the companies and drive up brick-and-mortar traffic at Nordstrom, because people could go to Nordstrom potentially to return or shuffle around merchandise in their Trunk Club boxes. When you look at the impact today of Trunk Club on Nordstrom, Nordstrom has seen nearly a $200 million depression in their EBIT since the partnership began in 2014 because of Trunk Club. So Trunk Club has largely lost Nordstrom money. They haven't seen the synergies they thought they might see. And what's more is Trunk Club doesn't offer a program where you can simply return merchandise to a Nordstrom. So it hasn't increased brick and mortar traffic. But there is an analyst, Elliot Darvish at the Sage Group, who hit the nail on the head. He mentioned that he was very skeptical of this deal because the whole concept was a little bit overdone as far as what Trunk Club supplied consumers, and because the deal seemed to be a very high premium for a company that was more or less unproven. And we've seen those things almost exactly play out today. Perhaps the biggest issue to Trunk Club, as I went onto their website and was playing around with it a little bit after the earnings release. First, the premise that shopping in stores for anyone is overwhelming and inconvenient. That's kind of a tenuous premise there. But Trunk Club has expanded to offer these services to women as well. Originally, it was men only. But they offer these services and they offer a fairly large limitation for sizes. Where shopping in stores is overwhelming and inconvenient is where you wear a different size or a size you might not find in a brick and mortar retail store. So whether that's a big or tall selection or just different sizes here and there on the men's and women's side, that's where shopping becomes overwhelming and inconvenient. But in this case, Trunk Club doesn't offer shoe sizes above 15. They don't offer a lot of pants sizes. And what's more, at least for men's clothing, they don't offer individualized sleeve sizes, which is a problem if you have really long or really short arms. They assume kind of that one size fits all based on shirt size. So it doesn't actually do anything of what it proposes to do, but basically it just puts together clothing from these retailers and ships it to your house. And Leighton, there are a lot of services that can do that, and a lot of them seem to be more fly-by-night. The real question is, now that I've unloaded all of that on our listeners, is keeping Trunk Club under the Nordstrom banner a win for the company going forward, or should they try to divest Trunk Club as soon as possible?
I think one of the basic premises here is that they need to figure out how to make this very profitable in a shorter amount of time. I think investors are going to be looking at the results of Trunk Club with a little bit more skepticism going forward now that they've released some numbers behind the acquisition. They're really not seeing a lot of growth here, and I think they do have a lot of competitors in this space, as you alluded to. One of them is Bombfell, the other is 54club.com, and the other being Franken Oat Hunt Club, which aren't really fly-by-night services anymore. These competitors have grown very much so over the past couple of years. 54 Club in particular has done a lot in promoting themselves and expanding their product selection as a subscription service. So going forward, Nordstrom's really shouldn't pay attention to the fact that they've had all of these sunk costs associated with Trunk Club. If Trunk Club is not working out, they need to be able to take a pragmatic view of this operation, and they might in fact have to divest Trunk Club. Whereas I think there is a lot of opportunity still to prove to shareholders that this is a viable part of the company. But as you said, it's kind of a conflict of interest to here have a company that really promotes the idea that going to the store is not the way to do business, at least in the fashion side of things. As for the stores, we talk about the company stores expanding just a little bit For fiscal 2016, Nordstrom, with their brick and mortar stores, opened 26 stores, relocated 3 stores, and closed 1 store. So they really haven't been closing many stores here domestically. They've actually been expanding, albeit quite modestly. Stores were opened in several regions throughout the U.S., so they really weren't concentrating on one particular region. However, they did include 5 in Canada. They opened 5 stores in Canada, which really has seen some positive feedback through these concepts. 21 more Nordstrom racks overall over the past 52 weeks, with 215 in total. So we talk about increasing margins, yet they're really focused more on the value offering with these Nordstrom racks. So that means they're operating quite effectively by opening these new locations. As for the stock, Nordstrom shares were slowly rising after the earnings report came out last Thursday, and they closed up around 3%. Shares are currently trading around $61 a share, up from Thursday's price of around $56 a share. So again, the stock price was up based on this earnings release. And over the past 52 weeks, the stock has been very volatile. If you look at the price, it has fluctuated between around $50 a share and $60 a share. The stock is currently at its one-year high, however. $11 billion market cap for this company. It appears as though the growth prospects are limited to Nordstrom Racks and their e-commerce segment, and that includes the Trunk Club.
Yeah, currently they have 123 full-line stores in the U.S., Canada, basically in North America. But in the U.S., between their full-line stores and rack stores, they have 348 stores in 40 states. So they're seeing greater brick-and-mortar market penetration. And they did say that they weren't perhaps the happiest with how Trunk Club has been assimilated into the overall Nordstrom set of brands, and that there is room for growth in the e-commerce segment. But I do like the fact that the company is comfortable with their market positioning. They know exactly where their two different brick and mortar stores fit in terms of the overall market. And one of the things we talked about with JCPenney was their brand collaborations. That's something that Nordstrom has really been hitting hard recently, now with collaborations with Ivy Park and J. Crew moving forward. Well, some negative news now from the world of retail is Kenneth Cole Productions announced that they will be shutting down all of their outlet stores. This will leave them just with a handful of brick and mortar stores in the United States. This is a huge blow for a company that was founded back in 1982.
Yeah, and it's had quite a storied history. Their first brick and mortar store was opened in 1984. So this dates back quite a ways. Their first brick and mortar store actually opened in New York City, where they still currently have a location. Having started off slowly by having started off with women's shoes and then expanding into accessories and handbags over the years, I think they've really built up this brand loyalty. Now you see a lot of licensing deals, and you see Kenneth Cole and a lot of different retailers here in the U.S. through different deals. You see them even in wholesale clubs. So you see here with these store closings that they're going to be focusing on these partnerships and their full price stores. Moreover, they're having a lot of trouble with their brand image as they have these value offerings inside these outlet stores. And I think that's something they really want to pivot to and have been looking to do for quite some time. However, this is quite contrarian to the idea that people are wanting more value. A lot of stores you see here as of late have been eyeing the outlet mall space to attract these value-oriented customers. We talk about Vineyard Vines and Toys R Us, which obviously isn't a fashion retailer, but they've been eyeing spaces in the outlet mall space, knowing that consumers have been really tight with their pocketbooks as of late. So Kenneth Cole here, by shutting down these outlet stores, is really telling their core consumer that we are still focused on the brand and we really do not want to devalue it. Their CEO this past week made a statement: as we continue on our path of strengthening our global lifestyle brand, we look to expand our full price retail footprint across the globe. And I think this is something, again, that is going to be reiterated in the years to come. Kenneth Cole is a privately held company, having once been publicly traded, as their IPO was in 1994. They are on the Indian stock market currently under symbol KCP, as they were taken private in the U.S. in 2012.
Mark Schneider, the CEO of Kenneth Cole, did tell Bloomberg that they want to continue their path of strengthening what they call their global lifestyle brand. But as you said, this runs contrary to a lot of U.S.-based stores going into the outlet malls. We talk about Vineyard Vines and Toys R Us, but also you look at Nordstrom offering their rack stores, which are somewhat off-price from the regular Nordstrom offerings. You look at Saks doing the exact same thing. So an interesting approach for Kenneth Cole, and you wonder if their time is limited as far as brick and mortar overall, since they only have a handful of brick and mortar stores that exist. Of course, you would assume with these closures, outside of the initial financial hit regarding these closures, that they would invest a little bit more in terms of their e-commerce infrastructure, and we'll keep an eye out for that over the next few months as KennethCole.com remains their website. But again, as with several e-commerce sites, you can see certainly where the e-commerce platform needs a little bit of help, more specifically with layout, because currently it is somewhat of a scattershot layout.
Yeah, they created actually a new website and rebranded a bit back in 2015 with hopes of getting some customer traffic to their website, but this really hasn't panned out, and I think they're going to be using the capital that's going to be freed up after these closings are complete to have another renewed focus on their e-commerce platform. They are also going to be refocused on the remaining brick and mortar locations, these full price locations, and they're going to also keep the international full price locations. And I think this is a good strategy for Kenneth Cole, since they do have a strong international presence. If they can build out this full price platform, I think this is going to suit them best in the long run if they were to still be focused on having good gross margins. Overall, I think they do have room to expand internationally as they, again, have built out their brand loyalty from overseas. They have brick and mortar presence in Africa, Asia, and Europe. And I think by building this out and really remaining focused on their brand, I think this is going to suit them well for the long term. I am curious to see how this pans out. Again, they have a lot of partnerships selling their lower price point items through a number of stores here in the U.S. They have a price point of around $30 to $250 for an average article of clothing. We'll move on to our last earnings call for this edition of the Retail Focus podcast. Kohl's reported their third quarter earnings last Thursday morning before the opening bell and gave strong indications that their business fundamentals are intact. The stock popped over 17% over the following 48-hour period. During the quarter, Kohl's recorded revenue of $4.327 billion, barely beating Thomson Reuters' estimate of $4.325 billion. So a very tiny beat on the revenue side of things. And this was down 2.3% year over year. So if you look at this objectively, analysts were expecting revenue to be down for the quarter, and it was. Adjusted earnings came in at $142 million or 80 cents per share, and this beat expectations of around 70 cents per share. So quite a large beat on earnings per share. Their share float was actually down because of continued share buybacks that were initiated from the company a while ago. Same store sales were down 1.7% for the quarter. Overall, they're looking to a strong holiday season despite some lackluster points from this third quarter report. They cited really strong back-to-school sales, which is really good because a lot of companies said they lacked back-to-school sales. So they had strong sales in the months leading up to September. However, they cited that September was soft due in part to the weather. A lot of retailers, including JCPenney that we were talking about earlier, reported softer sales in September because it was a warmer month than was expected. This was actually the warmest month on record. The month of September came in quite hot, and this caused fall sales in the fashion sector to be a little lower than we would normally see. Kohl's did say that they're going to be having to adjust to these weather conditions going forward, and they're going to be looking at some ways that they can better adjust to these levels. They said they're actually going to be innovating on a strategy called localization, which will be implemented throughout the next year, basically tailoring each region of the country to more precisely match the weather trends and weather patterns. And I think this is something that a lot of brick and mortar retailers are going to have to be focused on if they want to keep their inventories at a healthier level. As for inventories for the company, they did say that inventory levels were clean despite the sluggish month of September. They did say that quarter four is going to be up against a softer 2015 quarter four, which sets them up for a potential beat on revenue despite sales execution. I think sales execution may be fairly well off. Sales will be in a good spot for these holiday months because they cited better than expected October sales. So typically, if you look at the month of October, that is really a lead indicator for how your holiday season is going to fare. If you go a little bit further into the numbers, transactions per store were down 5.7%. This is bad news for Kohl's, considering they do want to build out their e-commerce infrastructure, but they want customers to be coming to their stores. Average transaction value increased 400 basis points. So the customers that are going to these stores are spending a little bit more. So that's good news, at least. Selling, general, and administrative expenses decreased $19 million to $1.1 billion for the quarter and deleveraged by about 12 basis points. I think they have a lot of headwinds going forward that they've been recognizing. They say that store payroll is going to be increasing due to wage inflation. And we talk about seasonal hiring. They're hiring a lot of temporary associates, and that is definitely going to affect the bottom line. During the quarter, they opened 6 Kohl's stores and closed just one store. They ended their third quarter with 1,155 stores. That is a lot of stores, and that indicates that they have deeply penetrated the domestic market in terms of brick and mortar. And Trent, I really have to wonder, where are they going to go from here, considering they are still positioning themselves as a growth company?
When you talk about where Kohl's can go from here, I look at their progress that they've made just in the calendar year 2016, and I think they've already made progress with their existing store footprint. You mentioned their store penetration as far as brick and mortar is pretty good at 49 states and 1,155 stores. They did open 6 Kohl's stores and closed just one during the most recent quarter. But you look back to the first quarter of fiscal year 2016, it ended April 30th of 2016, and there was a lot of sky is falling mentality surrounding a lot of analysts when they were looking at Kohl's because their comparable store sales fell 3.9%, and they also saw a reduction in their gross margin overall. So there were a lot of danger signs surrounding Kohl's. Then we moved to the second quarter, where same-store sales fell just 1.8% in comparison to the 3.9%. So the attitudes turned around a little bit. And then in this most recent quarter, you saw gross margin barely move whatsoever, and you saw comparable store sales only decrease by 1.7%. And again, you can blame certainly the warmer than usual weather. They said they had a strong back-to-school season that was partially offset by the warmer than usual weather. We'll have to kind of wait and see as certain department stores begin to report how much the warmer weather and the transition or lack of transition between summer and winter really affected top-line revenue at most of the United States clothing retailers. But as you mentioned, their transactions per store were down. However, on the other side of that, their average transaction value went up, and it was about half and half between the number of units per transaction and the average unit retail cost, which is a positive sign for the company. So the customers that they've been able to retain through things like their loyalty programs and through things like their mail-out coupons have been able to bring customers in that are loyal to the brand and that are willing to spend more at Kohl's. When you have a transaction loss of 5.7% for the quarter, and then you have that offset even partially by that increase in ticket price, that's a good sign for Kohl's moving forward. And if they can gather some of that traffic back in, especially coming up with Black Friday sales and especially coming up with strong holiday shopping months, then the future could be bright for Kohl's, and you'll see a reversal of fortunes that they saw throughout the first 9 months and really throughout the first quarter of 2016, where you saw same store sales just completely plummet, granted against very strong comps from a good 2015 year for Kohl's. When you look right now at the 9 months to date for Kohl's in 2016, in this fiscal year, you're seeing a 2.4% loss in comps over 2015, where at this point they had seen a 0.8% increase in their overall comps. As far as the financial well-being of the company, they still ended the quarter with about $600 million in cash and cash equivalents. They're investing money into a new e-commerce fulfillment center, so that's good news for Kohl's as well. And one of the things that you kind of referenced was their dividend. They offer a very high dividend to investors, and I think that's where Kohl's is trying to position themselves, at least as far as the stock market is concerned and as far as stock investors are concerned. They want to be a high dividend retailer that's fairly consistent from quarter to quarter. And because we don't see them as a growth store so much, basically all they have to do is maintain a slight level of growth year over year for overall company health. So far this year, they haven't done just that, but they are still issuing a strong dividend of 50 cents per share for shareholders of record as of December 7th, 2016. From an investment side of things, there may be things to like as far as Kohl's is concerned, but for the retail side of things, you don't really see where they're going to develop anything. They don't have store-in-store concepts like JCPenney. They haven't introduced new brand connections at all. They're pretty much just keeping on keeping on, which for Kohl's, they've been such a strong retailer for so long in terms of same-store sales. That's not necessarily a negative thing, but as long as they can keep same-store sales increasing by about 1% each year, that remains to be a positive symbol. But first, they have to really perform well in the fourth quarter. As you mentioned, they saw a strong sales uptick a little bit in October after a strong back-to-school sales sandwich that week September. But that October sales trend needs to continue in November and December for Kohl's to make sure that they didn't lose a ton of same-store sales overall in this fiscal year.
Yeah, and it is interesting to see their Black Friday focus on several categories in their stores. They're going to be focused on a slew of categories, including men's apparel, women's activewear, footwear, home goods, toys, and electronics. They have some cameras, Fitbits, and a sound bar for sale for their Black Friday event. Their Black Friday event actually does start on Thanksgiving, starts Thursday at 6 p.m. and rolls through that following Friday. So a lot of exciting areas of growth if you're looking at Kohl's categories overall. And I think that is the modest area for growth for them. The last quarter, men's was actually the strongest category for the third consecutive quarter. Footwear also outperformed the company's general average. Children's and accessories were the weakest. So I think through this Black Friday promotion, they're going to be focusing on all categories to see which one prevails and which one they can really focus on going forward as an opportunity for growth.
Well, we finish up a very apparel-heavy retail focus with news that American Apparel has officially filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy as of this week. This is their second foray into bankruptcy over the last 2 years. What's different about this bankruptcy is that in this circumstance, Canadian t-shirt and apparel maker Gildan Activewear Incorporated said it has agreed to buy the intellectual property rights of the American Apparel brand and certain assets from the company for about $66 million in cash straight up. This includes the opportunity for them to maintain some or all of American Apparel's current Los Angeles production and distribution operations. A lot has been made in the news over the last 5 to 6 years of their LA production and distribution operators, the idea that they're completely made in the U.S. However, they've seen a complete falling out over the last couple of years, and their most recent bankruptcy is taking place in all likelihood because they didn't really fix the issues they were having the first time they filed for bankruptcy.
Yeah, that's right. If you look back to about this time last year, early October of 2015, American Apparel filed for their Chapter 11 bankruptcy. And I think this was a deal that really didn't work out too well. What had ended up happening through the bankruptcy settlement was the debtors would take on some of the company's equity. So they would end up getting a debt transfer to equity, and the company ended up taking on several million dollars more in debt through other sources. So I think this type of restructuring ended up being a bad thing for the company. But as far as the merchandising aspect, what they wanted to do was refresh their product selection. So about 75% of their planned lineup was changed through the following quarters after that bankruptcy last year. And that didn't end up working out, as you see same-store sales dropping quite significantly. Last quarter, you saw American Apparel see a drop of 33% in same-store sales. Typically, you and I talk about bad same-store sales coming in between anywhere from negative 2 to 5%, but we're talking about 33% in same-store sales, and this is based off of a refreshed selection in the remaining stores. So this is not a good piece of news for the company, and if you look at the amount of stores the company has left, they have 117 United States operations, and this was actually down almost about half from when they filed bankruptcy last year. They had about 230 stores worldwide and over 8,500 employees. So they've cut that significantly, and they still have not been able to operate well on a store-by-store basis. So a lot of problems here, and it really is so interesting to see how a bankruptcy that was so recent really didn't do any good into restructuring any growth prospects for the company. Overall, the company had a lot of positivity around it when it was founded back in 1989. Again, there was an emphasis on domestic production and wholesaling here through a lot of different partnerships, but and it ended up seeing a peak close to around 2006. In 2005, they were ranked 308th in Inc.'s list of the 500 fastest growing companies in the United States. So again, a lot of positive things were surrounding this company for the longest time, but around 2008, the company started seeing some woes as far as same store sales. And in 2010, there was a massive downturn with the news that the 2009 financial statements that were issued by the company may not be reliable. So the continued debt financing and these slowing sales forced the company into the 2015 bankruptcy, followed by this latest news that the company will be selling some operations off. The judge has to approve the Gildan activewear acquisition if Gildan does in fact want to buy the intellectual property rights for American Apparel, but it seems as though there is no buyer for the remaining 117 U.S. locations. So this is going to be a little sad for the company. If they can't find a buyer, they will end up having to be sold and liquidated thereafter.
I don't think there's any question that a lot of their 117 U.S. stores that are still in operation are going to have to be liquidated. They're probably worth more in terms of their real estate now than they are as American Apparel stores or as functioning stores as an extension of their overall brand. Something the Wall Street Journal mentioned is that there are a lot of brands of products that stayed alive through some of the more recent retail pressures that have produced bankruptcies in other areas. But American Apparel hasn't been able to do that. And when you're talking about same-store sales declines of 33%, I'm pretty sure you could burn down stores and get less same-store sales declines than that. So the re-merchandising solution just didn't work. And in fact, Mark Weinstein said that the brand's turnaround strategy completely failed. He was American Apparel chief restructuring officer. So a lot of negative news for American Apparel. As you mentioned, $215 million in debt as of October of last year. But even then, they talked about their balance sheets and their finances being somewhat shaky. And it's unlikely to see anything other than this Gildan activewear deal helping to pull them out of debt. And I can't see them retaining a brick and mortar presence, even if they find a way to come back out of debt. One thing we should mention is that there is a credit firm, Encina Business Credit LLC, which is an asset-based retail lending operation. According to the Wall Street Journal, they're trying to lead some rescue financing, which is a six-month loan that would possibly carry the company to May 2017, but it's yet to be seen as to whether that will come through or whether or not the bankruptcy judge will instead side with the sale of part of the business to Gildan Activewear.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
Well, Well, as we close out this episode of the Retail Focus Podcast, as we do every week, we each give you a story that we're looking ahead to over the next week or the next month, and we begin with Leighton.
So there's going to be a lot of earnings coming up in the retail sector, and this is something that we're going to be very focused on as we're going to be digging through stories to see what's relevant for next week's Retail Focus Podcast. But as of today, Lowe's, L Brands, and Target will be reporting earnings, and then Thursday, Best Buy, Gap, and Ross Stores will all be reporting, as well as Staples and Walmart. So there are just so many companies in the retail industry that are going to be reporting. The ones that stick out to me are, however, L Brands and Ross. L Brands, because they had actually diminished their full year guidance this last month, and they looked to be struggling in the Victoria's Secret segment of their business. So this is something we're going to be looking at very closely to see if they meet their expectations. And then as with Ross is a company that has really come up in the last year or so as a company that has seen massive growth prospects, being a value-oriented company. You see this has been a company that has really been focused on their customer and getting value to their customer, and you've seen a lot of store count growth too associated with Ross. So this is going to be a company I'm looking to see if they can gain on the earnings per share side of things and their overall outlook for 2017 and beyond.
Well, my story that I'm looking ahead to is more of a looking back, or as much of a looking back, as the retail industry as a whole mourns the loss of Stater Brothers chairman and CEO Jack H. Brown. Now, Stater Brothers, you might recognize as a grocer in California. They'd been in the news a lot over the last couple of decades, but more recently, in part because the grocery store chain didn't want to sell to any other store chains, and what's more is they weren't taking on expansion plans. This was an intentional decision by the late Mr. Brown, and I'm anxious to see not only where the company goes from here, but whether or not they will, as a group, choose to uphold his legacy and remain an independent retailer going forward. But Jack H. Brown certainly served the retail and grocery industry well, and we are certainly sorry to see his loss. And thoughts and condolences go out to his family and also the employees there at Stater Brothers, who are in a state of mourning. Well, that'll do it for us on the Retail Focus Podcast. For Leighton, I'm Trent. So long for this week. Reminder to check us out on Twitter at Retail Podcast. You can also find us on iTunes, Stitcher, and any other podcast delivery service, including Podbean. Have a great week, and we'll be back with Food Focus on Friday.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.